To order. We would welcome our members and to those of you in the audience, welcome. We will open with House Bill 3504. We'll open the work session on House Bill 3504, and it looks like Representative Anderson is about coming up. Yes, so we'll do it in a second. Excuse me, can I open a work session?
Yes.
Well, I'm thinking ahead a bit prematurely. We'll rescind the work session at this point, and we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3504. And thank you, Jim.
Ready?
And we're ready.
House Bill 3504, directs school districts to implement school peer review committee program to resolve student conflicts, directs courts to award costs and attorney fees to the school district if the district is prevailing party in a civil action. And there are amendments.
Good afternoon, Representative.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chair Beckland and members. For the record, I'm Representative Gordon Anderson from District 3, Grants Pass and Illinois Valley. I'm here in support of House Bill 3504. This bill is fairly explanatory, and the need for it, I believe, is fairly apparent. Therefore, my comments will be brief. Much attention has been paid to the problems associated with schoolyard bullies or kids that are out of control over the past years. Most of the attention focuses on strategies for dealing with the behavior of the child. So far, no one that I've heard has dealt with potential fallout to the school associated with this problem. Several weeks ago, I went back to my home district and met with a number of teachers, and they brought this issue up as being an outstanding problem in their area. This bill would correct one small portion of the out-of-control child problem. Perhaps more importantly, this bill will help schools alleviate some of their funding crunch in these lean times. The bill stems from a case in Grants Pass where a student is a chronic bully in two different school yards over several months. Over time, after other students have tired of his behavior, the bully has gotten into fights with other children. Most of us remember the days when that was the end of it. The bully would skulk off, having been put in his place, and the problem was generally fixed. In this case, however, the parents of the bully have sued numerous times against the school district, attempting to collect money for supposed damage to their child. In each case, the school district has prevailed. The money used to fight these cases, however, can be substantial. In addition, these suits can result in lost instruction time as teachers are called in as witnesses, and substitute teachers have to be paid to watch the class. Also, in this case, as the student is a special education student, the federal government has paid the costs associated with the education, including damage awards from a lawsuit. But suppose the student was not a special education student, and the district does have the liability for the suit. And really, should we be okay with our federal tax monies funding frivolous lawsuits and take comfort in knowing that the money is not coming from our own state taxes? I think not. Whether the money comes from the right pocket or the left, it's still our money, and we should be good stewards of it and oppose its waste. Moreover, the school principal must divert his attention from supervising instruction. In a budget climate where schools find themselves with shrinking budgets and shortened school years, it would seem that both the money and the teacher's time would be better spent in the classroom. Therefore, this bill seeks to discourage frivolous lawsuits such as those in the example I mentioned by requiring that when the school district is the subject of a civil action, if the district prevails, the court shall award school district reasonable attorney fees. I believe that the benefits of this section are apparent to this committee, so I will not take the time to list them. Instead, let me continue to an explanation of the 1-1 amendments. The amendment eliminates sections 1 and 2, the requirement that a school district establish a peer review committee. I believe you all have those 1 amendments. The intent was that this committee might be able to assist in mediating problems before they went to a court case. Well, this is a good idea. I believe that in these times that schools find themselves in, it's not the best time to mandate a new program. In addition, the amendment allows the inclusion of individual public schools in the protections afforded by the bill. Unfortunately, the relating to clause did not allow for private schools to be protected in this bill, and protection of them for them might be added at a later date. Members of the committee, I thank you for hearing this bill, and I urge your adoption of the -1 amendments and the passage of the engrossed bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson, thank you very much. The bill was brought, or the information that led to the bill was brought to you, to your attention by the school people in your district in Grants Pass.
Yes.
So those people felt that there was enough of a problem that the bill was a good remedy.
The parent had lived at one school, North Highland, or Highland School, in that area. The child went to that school. They sued three times at that school. Now they've moved to another school and have sued a fourth time. And the parent has, since that time, tried to move to a third school district. And the supervisor said, you know, for the best interest of your child, let's keep him at the second school at least till the end of the year, just for his benefit. And the parent is obviously out of control, as is the child. But the teachers felt that it was wasting their time greatly, not only in a playground, but in the classroom, and then it was costing the school district quite a bit of money. One issue did come up, and I think it needs to be mentioned. The superintendent said, at some point in the future, we might want to even look at this and say, not shall, but may have court costs associated, because we're put in a position, and he would have been here, but he had a conflict. We're put in a position that we don't want to aggravate the parents in the school district by suing, by being sued and then claiming monies from that out-of-control parent. Yes, we'd like the money, but we feel a little restraint to push too hard. But I think he was happy with the bill as it stands, as amended, and I think for this time we certainly could put it through and let them adjudicate whether they really want to accept the attorney's fees or not.
Hmm. Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. As I read the amendment, it refers to any civil action brought against a school district. It's not limited to civil actions brought by students or on behalf of students. So is it your understanding that it would apply, for example, in a completely unrelated case? Say the driver of a school bus is involved in a crash on a street or highway, and there is some court proceeding to determine fault, and the court can't determine whether it was the driver's fault or not, so it's a hung jury or dismissed. You could say that the school district prevailed because they weren't held liable. Would the person who brought that action then have to pay the school district's fees under this?
I think that ought to be left in the hands of the judge to determine what's fair. Because if it's a hung jury or if it's essentially not determined in one side or the other, I would think the judge would not allow damages, would be my feeling.
A follow-up.
It raises an issue, Representative, because the language here says shall, and I'm not sure that gives the judge discretion to do that. I also wonder if it applies, for example, to employment cases where you'd have an employee of the school district bring a suit and a settlement out of court happens. Is the school district then determined to have prevailed, and is there a liability to pay for fees?
I like your suggestion. We had thought about the shall and may, and that would definitely clear up some of these issues fairly quickly, where the school district could determine if they felt that it was in their best interest or not the best interest.
My interest is making sure I know what I'm voting on and how it would be applied.
Okay.
Thanks.
Sure, except the chance to go back and amend it for you.
So we would need some clarification of Representative Nolan's question about an out-of-court settlement.
Out-of-court, and does it apply
yes.
to other parties? I mean, Representative mm-hmm. Anderson brought it because of a student issue.
Mm-hmm.
The way it's written, it says any civil action. Mm-hmm. Does it apply mm-hmm. to automobile accidents? Does it apply to other actions against the school district employment mm-hmm. claims? Mm-hmm. This is pretty sweeping as I read it.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you very much. In somewhat of a response to Representative Nolan, I don't think it would apply out of court, would it? If there were out of court settlements, that wouldn't allow a judge to enter into a decision. I also think that the judge has guidelines that he has to follow, that something has to qualify. Do you know anything about if there's any qualifications that a judge, the test has to be met to qualify for a
warrant? I don't. Maybe one of the attorneys here could.
Representative Scott, I'm going to look to my left. And I see Representative Avalian here, and perhaps, Representative, you could help us out.
Well, I think Representative Scott is right that in there is a definition already that's statutory on what a prevailing party is, and prevailing parties don't include settlements unless within the settlement you identify somebody as a prevailing party, which virtually never happens. And I would just raise the same concern that Representative Nolan did, that this reads to me as any civil action which would include personal injury cases, that would include things such as when teachers commit sexual abuse or another employee does, they get sued. It could include when school districts are involved in litigation over inadequate IEPs, all types of things. And then the shall, I believe under existing law, a judge already has the authority in a frivolous case to award these things when he deems it a frivolous case. This would mandate that attorney fees be awarded, even in very close cases. And I would say that if this comes back to us, we should be thinking in terms of things like Brown v. Board of Education and other very significant cases that did involve school districts, but that were very poor individuals fighting against government abuse in very appropriate cases. And you want to make sure they have equal access, and this would squelch that considerably. Mm-hmm. So the shall is something we need to look very closely at.
Okay. Dr. Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. They said everything. All my circles.
it's hard for me to believe that a former teacher and superintendent would have nothing to say at this point, but I'll accept it. Well, thank you very much. Representative, do you have anything further to add? You've listened to Representative Nolan's questions, excellent ones, and to Representative Avakian's analysis. We would be happy if you have anything to add, and I think probably it's pretty clear that we should not go to work session, that there is some work to be done here before we do that.
Fine.
Yeah.
Thank you. If you'll excuse me, I'm going to run to the rigors of judiciary.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming in, and thank you for your bill.
Yeah.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3504. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2575. Jim, do you want to provide us a...
Yes, sir. House Bill 2575 allows the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to set the time period for the issuance of initial teaching, personal service, and administrative licenses, modifies the requirements for the issuance of continuing teacher, personal services, and administrative licenses, declares an emergency, takes effect on passage, and we have amendments.
Okay. Committee members, you recall very early on in the session, we were asked to adopt a committee, LC, I think, at that time, and it has now come back in the form of House Bill 2575. We had an overview of the TSPC by Vicki Chamberlain, and so we're back with House Bill 2575, and I do have a couple amendments that I've had written, but at this point, before we go there, I think we have signed up Elise, is that Lunas? Very good, Elise.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members, for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Elise Lunas. I'm here just representing myself. And I would also, before I start, like to thank Representative Scott for his interest in this piece of legislation and for his interest in his constituents' concerns. Thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts regarding House Bill 2575. Let me begin by saying that in general, I support this bill as it eliminates some of the serious problems that exist in the current law. I hope it quickly passes through the legislative process, although I am a little nervous that it leaves most of the licensing requirements for an initial and continuing license in the hands of the Teaching Standards and Practices Commission. Apparently, until the legislation passes, TSPC is unable to tell me what the requirements will be that would replace the existing provisions. I have to take it on faith that whatever requirements they determine will be reasonable and not adversely affect my ability to teach and earn a living. The law as it currently exists adversely affects many new teachers who have become licensed since it was enacted in 1999. In my own case, I received my initial license to teach in Oregon classrooms in September of 2000. Since receiving my license, I have spent more than 1,000 hours each year as a substitute teacher, sometimes with long-term assignments of up to 3 months with a class. During this time, I have continued to seek full-time teaching employment in my community and surrounding school districts. I continued to work toward my continuing license by taking an additional 6 quarter-hour credits at the graduate level and receiving a master's degree in education from Portland State University. Under current law, to qualify for a continuing teaching license, you must have 3 years of successful experience teaching at least half-time. According to TSPC, no amount of successful substitute teaching experience qualifies. Also, since an initial license is renewable only once for an additional 3-year period, if I do not secure an employment contract with a school district for next fall and then keep from getting laid off for the next 3 years, my teaching career in Oregon will end. Under current law, there does not appear to be any licensure provision for me to continue, even as a substitute teacher, beyond 2006 when my initial license will expire. House Bill 2575 removes this arbitrary time limit. I know from speaking with fellow graduates from the teacher education program that I'm not alone in this situation. Some have taken a couple of years out to start a family, and if they do not secure a position next fall, they will be forever unable to resume their teaching careers. With the projected layoffs around the state, the picture is bleak. The questions that I have related to House Bill 2575 are, what will be the requirements established by the commission by rule? For a continuing license, what will be the minimum period of time to be determined by the commission of employment? And will substitute teaching hours be considered as employment? For the continuing license, what changes are being planned for the advanced professional education program approved by the commission? Currently, the educational credits I have taken since obtaining my initial license and which earned me an MED will not count toward the continuing education requirements for a continuing license. Again, if these questions cannot be addressed in a timely way in the legislation, my preference would be to have House Bill 2575 pass as is. This would remove the overly restrictive provisions in current law and hopefully give TSPC an opportunity to craft more flexible licensing provisions. Thank you for my opportunity to support this legislation.
Okay. Thank you, Elise. Yes, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Before you go away.
Elise, would you?
Oh, sorry.
Save
you didn't
more,
give
please.
Us.
Yeah.
If I'm to understand your testimony, is it your feeling that substitute teaching should be accumulative to the point where it would count as experience?
I would hope that would be the case, especially since my substitute teaching experience has been one where I do carry forward the curriculum of the teacher every day that I teach, and I've had long-term substitute teaching assignments where I've had to do everything, including working with parents, planning the curriculum, doing the assessments, grading. I mean, it's been the whole nine yards. And so it seems like it would be appropriate for substitute teaching experience to count towards the time for a continuing license.
Follow up.
Have you, thank you, Mr. Chair, under these conditions, have you been evaluated in the exact same method that a regular contracted teacher has been evaluated?
I have had, on the long-term assignments, I have had principals come in and observe my teaching and that kind of thing. I don't believe there's a permanent record necessarily, although I don't know that for a fact.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Elise is the only one signed up. Vicki Chamberlain is here, and she's indicated she would come up if necessary. And so you can be our backup. If you'd like to come up, Vicki, you can, but... Okay. We will close the public hearing on House Bill 2575, and we'll open a work session on House Bill 2575. And members, if you would look at the dash ones, it would be my intention to move the dash ones today. When we were given our overview some weeks ago, Vicki Chamberlain indicated through a number of ways, charts and explanations, what the requirements were, and I was struck by the fact that particularly for out-of-state teachers who come to Oregon, this may be a problem. They would be forced to have a master's degree after 7 years, I believe, through two teaching licenses. Or if they did not have a master's degree at that time, they would no longer be able to teach in our state. And I was thinking about the many, many, many people I've taught with, the many, many people I've known, and I got to thinking that once experienced, somehow a requirement of a master's degree seemed to be an old mistake. I don't know if I want to say arbitrary, but maybe unnecessary would be a good choice. And so we had this amendment written, and I think that would particularly benefit those teachers who are coming from out of state. I remember the statistic that something like a majority of our new teachers come from out of state, and they go through these licensure requirements. Most of the Oregon prepared teachers have come through an MAT program, and they already have a master's degree. But to be required to have one seems to me to be the focus here. I would certainly encourage anyone who's going to teach to get a master's degree. I think there are a number of benefits. But we're just saying we question if we need to have it as a requirement to teach in our state. So that's kind of a quick background, and that's what I would like to do today. Also, I had written a dash two. But some information has come to me. We've had some conversations, and I don't know that it would be wise to move dash two because there could be some unintended consequences, or there could be some information that I'm not aware of, and that we're not aware of. And so I only propose to move the dash one today until we work on this, and we'll be back next week with hopefully an agreement that is a pretty good one. Or even a better than a pretty good one. So anyway, does anyone have any comments? Does anyone propose to move this dash one?
Mr. Chair, if you're open to discussion first.
I am.
Mm-hmm. I see in my stat some other amendments.
Which one's representing? Oh.
Three and four.
Three and four?
In particular, the dash three.
Yeah. The dash three is frankly, I would say, an alternative. Dash three was brought to us by Vicki Chamberlain. she had asked that she be allowed to draft an amendment. I said, fine. And this is what's come to us. The dash threes, I would sum up and basically say that there be a commitment for TSPC to discuss and evaluate current teacher licensure procedures or requirements. And this would be, I would consider to be kind of an alternative to the dash one, today's amendment offer. So the dash four, are you referencing a dash four?
Well, the reason Mr. Chair, I don't feel that I have enough in the public record for me to be in a position to pass judgment on what should or shouldn't be in our licensing requirements. And it seems the dash ones assume that we are in a position to make that judgment, whereas the dash three asks the people who are the pros to make that judgment.
Okay.
So that's why I wanted to understand I just don't know that I feel qualified to support to determine a licensing requirement without more public record.
I guess my view is, I don't want this to appear to be rash, in as much as I've thought about this off and on in terms of requirements for teacher licensures since I began teaching in 1961. And over a period of a long time, there have been a number of teachers who have had, let's say, some difficulties with what they perceive to be the inflexibility of the licensure rules. And so I'm reacting to the idea that, if you ask people, which I've done, and I've thought about my own experience, is it necessary to have a master's degree to be a good teacher? And I don't think it is. And if you're particularly from out of state, which more than half of our new teachers are, to be required to have a master's after 7 years of teaching, if they don't have one, they cannot teach in Oregon. And to me, that would seem to be unnecessary or a mistake.
And you have the professional background to evaluate that. I just don't have anything in my record that makes the case the other way. Yeah. So I don't know how to evaluate which of those courses of actions is the best public policy.
And I don't know if it's really significant, but I guess as the chair, I've received quite a few emails, and they're complaints about current licensure requirements. And I certainly like the direction of our discussions with Vicki Chamberlain, that there's going to be discussions and evaluations and changing timelines. I think that's good, but I think we have a policy setting committee, and we don't want to meddle, I know, but it seems to me this is a reasonable thing. Representative Hodson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since we're having discussion, I'm getting tired of everybody saying what I was going to say. I agree with Representative Nolan, as you well know, because we've had the discussion, and I think both of our professional judgment certainly puts us in a place to make that decision. The difference is that I am not convinced that the requirement for a master's degree is unnecessary. It may be. But I firmly believe that my opinion and anybody else's on this committee should be secondary to what we have set up the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to do, because that is the charge we have given to them to make those decisions. So I'm somewhat uncomfortable in usurping that place. I certainly agree with you that there have been innumerable problems over the years, some of them because the requirements were too rigid, others, and I hate to say this about our beloved profession, but others perhaps because teachers failed to do what they were required to do in a timely manner. I surely not, but I have heard cases of that happening as well. So I do have trouble with the amendments 1 and 2 particularly.
Okay. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few brief comments. Whereas I don't have a teaching background, I've received evidence on this particular issue to really believe myself to agree with the chair. We've seen quite a bit of individual cases where it simply was too rigid, and I don't think we need to delay this by putting it through the Standards and Practices Board. I think we can go ahead and move the dash ones and get the legislation out.
Mr. Chair. Thank you. Yes, Representative Lawson.
Since I'm gathering that the crux of our discussion up here is probably something that would be helped by Vicki's testimony with regard to the amendments as well, and wonder, since I think she's eager to get up here, maybe we could hear and then continue.
Okay, that's fine, yes.
Thank you, Chair Backlund, members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. I'm chomping at the bit back there because of something I mentioned to you last night, Representative Backlund in particular, when the first time I saw these amendments. The first two lines of the proposed amendments on the initial license don't capture the intent of what you're trying to do, but really, really tie our hands for our Oregon licensed teachers. Because we have to require a master's degree for the MAT programs for them to be licensed. I mean, that's just the way the programs are structured. And the language here says that in the initial license that we could not require a master's degree or a doctoral degree. Well, we don't anyway. Any out-of-state teacher comes into the state can get their initial license without having a master's degree. It's the permanent continuing license they cannot achieve without having received a master's degree. So what you're trying to do would occur in lines 5 and 6. In lines 2 and 3, we would have a very serious problem with the current design of our programs in the higher ed institutions, is the one thing I wanted to say.
Vicki, if I may interrupt. So you're saying if we were on the dash ones, if we were to remove lines 1, 2, and 3, then the remaining lines 4, 5, and 6 would capture the correct approach, you would say, if we move dash ones. I mean, if we move
it would
amendment.
Capture your intent.
Yeah.
I guess I can't say yes, it would capture the correct approach.
Yes. I understand that. Committee, I we did have a meeting yesterday afternoon, and Vicki mentioned this, and so we did have an amendment prepared that would do exactly as Vicki has said, and that is the dash four. And so we could go to the dash four, if, especially if you think that would be much more, let's say, realistic.
I don't.
At least capture my intent.
I don't have the dash fours. Chair Backlund, I do want to take the liberty of being sure I'm on record that the commission opposes what you're doing, mm-hmm. and thinks it's problematic for the licensure system. I have seen the dash fours. I don't have them. I glanced at them. I was told they weren't going to happen, and so
yeah. I think it's just the second part.
I see.
Yeah.
So what are you asking me?
Well, I think the purpose of my question was that we should remove, or you would suggest that we remove lines 1, 2, and 3 from dash 1.
I would ask that you do that if you are intent on moving ahead with eliminating the master's degree requirement. The dash 1 amendments would be a horrible problem for us.
Okay. Thank you very much. By the way, Vicki, I did want you to know that I noticed as I looked back to that you were anxious to come up, kind of leaning forward. And
I was trying to be fly.
I know that. No, that's fine. No, so,
thank you.
So very good. Thank you. Okay. Any other comments? The thing about the dash ones, I guess, is it makes it clear that a master's degree is not required in any license that's granted. And I guess I was thinking that the dash fours were maybe the way to go, but But the whole point of this is to say that a master's degree is not required to teach in our state. By the way, only 8 states do require a master's degree. Only 8. Also, Jim checked the website for the No Child Left Behind and determined what a highly qualified teacher was, and it does not require a master's degree. So I felt fairly comfortable in going the direction that I'm proposing here. So we're going to stick with one. Do we have a motion? Representative Farr.
Mr. Chair, I move the -1 amendments.
Thank you. Representative Farr moves the -1 amendments to House Bill 2575. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nolan.
I'm now very confused. Doesn't the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission issue licenses to programs that require master's degrees? And we're now telling them that they can't do that with this amendment?
We have a
higher ed, for example, and other situations. Mr. Chair, I want to be clear.
Yeah.
I don't believe that the public record available to me is sufficient to pass either of these amendments. I have heard members of the committee talk about information that they have in their records, but I don't believe it's in the public record of this committee. But in particular, I'm very concerned about passing legislation that prohibits a commission from doing what it is obligated to do.
Okay, I understand. We're talking, however, just the initial teaching license and just the continuing teacher license. And those licenses are required for K through 12.
Okay.
Okay. Any other discussion? Gina, would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Thompson? Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Thompson?
No.
Representative Nolan?
No.
Representative Scott?
Aye.
Representative
Thompson? No. Aye. Hearing a constitutional or having a constitutional majority, we will declare that the -1s are passed and are amended into House Bill 2575. We are not going to move beyond this amendment today. We do have some further consideration. So thank you very much for the discussion. I hope it didn't put the audience to sleep, but it was good for us. So, yes, we will close the work session on House Bill 2575, and we'll open an informational meeting on the Minority Teacher Report, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission.
Chair Backlund, members of the committee, for the record, I'm James Sager, Education Policy Advisor to the Governor, and as I now understand my role since coming on the 1st of March, in the future it will be my responsibility to make sure that this report is pulled together, and I appreciate the fact that the university system stepped up and kind of filled that void for me in my absence, and so I'm going to ask my distinguished colleagues here to present the report to you and open up to questions.
Thank you. Representative Backlund, members of the committee, I'm Holly Zandel, Associate Vice Chancellor for Academic Affairs with the Oregon University System, and this for this 6th biennial report, our agency took the lead in pulling together the report that is required by the Minority Teacher Act, which was passed by the 1991 legislature. And I'm assuming you all have a copy of the report, and it's not our intention to go over this long report today, but just to hit a few of the highlights, share with you some of the concerns that we have, particularly as it may play out in future years. The summary of the report is really on pages 1 through 4, and in 1991, the legislature set a goal, a benchmark, that by 2001, the number of minority teachers, including administrators, employed by school districts in the state would be approximately proportionate to the number of minority children enrolled in the schools. In 2001, when we were approaching that 10-year benchmark, we issued a report to the legislature and indicated that, unfortunately, we had not met our goal. And in 2001, the proportion of school-aged children was 19.3%, but the percent of minority teachers was only 4.1%. In 2003, unfortunately, the picture is somewhat worse because the gap has now widened. The percent of minority students in Oregon public schools are now 21.4%, and the percent of minority teachers is still only 4.4%, and administrators are 5.7%. What we've done in the report on pages 2 and 3 is portray the kind of pipeline that we believe the Act asked us to do, which was to describe the array of students in the public schools, look at high school graduates, look at the students who are in the community college enrollments, look at the students who are in the public universities, look at those who graduate from the public universities by different degree areas, those who complete teacher preparation, and then those who go on to get a license. And that really does then describe the pipeline, and you can see how the numbers kind of funnel down so that we end up with a much smaller percent of people actually coming out and getting a license. The second set of statistics on top of page 3 then describe the employment picture in the schools, and you'll see that there are only 4.4% of teachers who are minorities, and you can see the breakout. What we've been doing, as we've been doing these reports over the years, is meeting in various groups talking about how can we improve the situation, knowing that we really, any one of our agencies obviously cannot control and major parts of the pipeline or even on the employment side. But we feel that we're doing a lot of initiatives to try to improve things. And so although the 1991 Act does not require us to provide anything other than counting, we have provided a lot of context-related information in this report, so you will have a sense of the number of activities which are underway at the universities in partnership to try to recruit more students into students of color into teacher education, to try to deal with some of the attrition problems of teachers in the schools, et cetera. One of the things that I would like to be sure that you note is that most of these initiatives are supported by federal funds, federal grant funds. If those funds were, if and when they are to leave some of those individual projects, we would be left probably with even more challenges in terms of expanding the pipeline of teachers of color who could take positions in our schools. We presented this report to the Joint Boards of Education a couple of weeks ago and had a good discussion about issues of concern within all of our agencies. And Vicki Chamberlain sat in with us because this is such an important issue to the Commission as well. And I'll stop, and maybe Vicki will add some comments too.
Chair Backlund, members of the committee, Vicki Chamberlain, TSPC. The interesting thing about this issue has been how it's changed since 1991 when this initiative started. I think the intent then is that we would have equity in employment, and that people believe that if we had equity in employment, we had numbers of teachers that were role models for the students that are in the classes, that we would get to where we would want to get in education. Obviously, we haven't been able to do that, and people have asked the commission, what are you doing to increase the numbers of minority students in the schools? And frankly, there's nothing the commission, as a commission, as a group, can do that. I mean, the colleges have their own recruiting programs, and that becomes an issue, and obviously we're not involved in hiring for school districts. My concern, however, is that there has been a steady movement of minority candidates through the programs and into the profession and into the buildings, and we can't keep them, and that we have attrition of our minority candidates. And I think there is something the commission can do about that, and that means looking at our teaching standards and perhaps what kind of collegial environment that we're having as teachers and cultural competency. So I think it's not a numbers issue. I think it's about how friendly are we in terms of being professional. And the commission has a commitment over this next 2 years to take a look at cultural competency standards for teacher preparation and continued licensure so that we can tackle it. It's not a diversity issue per se.
So, again, I just want to underline my concern is we've had a steady influx. We're obviously not keeping those teachers. So, mm-hmm. We need to look at that.
And I want to add one more point, too, and that is that the colleges and universities in 1995-96 had prepared 50 teachers of color. In 2001, there were 171, and the following year, 191. So that is a very large increase, although it doesn't seem like very much in the scheme of things. For the universities, that's a very large increase. We lose some of those people who don't go on to get a license in Oregon. They leave for positions in other states. And then some of them are out actively looking for positions in schools, aren't able to find them. That's a concern we have now with the likely poor job situation for future teachers. And then for some of those that are hired, they have the attrition problem. So we have problems and challenges all along the way, and it's something that if there was a good thing about doing this report, Jim, there are some good things about doing the report, Jim, and that is we've all become kind of friends among ourselves. We work together very well behind the scenes, and we realize that for us to make significant progress, we really have to collaborate and attract grant dollars where we can and work together on our policies to try to improve things as best we can. And I think our group would stop there and take questions if you have them.
Okay. Not a question, but maybe really a comment. It's interesting that the report indicates that the total number of minorities licensed by TSPC who were prepared outside Oregon in the last 2 years exceeds the number prepared within Oregon. And so I'm sure that that's of concern, and we'd like to increase the number of minority teachers that we are preparing from Oregon institutions. I would guess that.
Representative Backlund, our friends in the Oregon Personnel Association, who we work with behind the scenes also, have told us that the school districts have been very active recruiting at fairs and other situations nationally to fill shortages, particularly in the area of bilingual, other areas in which our colleges really don't have sufficient capacity to prepare all the people that we ought to prepare. This is an area that we've been expanding in, but I think that the out-of-state percentages represent just how aggressive our districts have been at trying to go out there and fill those positions. And unfortunately, they're competing with states that offer many more attractive incentives than we're able to offer as well.
Yeah. Well, Holly, like money.
Yes.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For a comment, first of all, I think it's wonderful, and I hope you can continue to do it. And I hope in doing it you help folks like me that the percentages are often more helpful than the numbers, because when you're comparing with other states, the number is almost meaningless unless you have a really good idea what the populations are. An additional question, I realize it's not under the purview of this particular report, but is there any discussion in regard to getting out the information on gender differences in the various categories, particularly in administration?
That's a wonderful question, Representative Hudson and members of the committee. We did provide a bit of gender information. You saw that on the pages, because teaching still is primarily a female-dominated field, and we've been working hard, particularly to attract more men who would teach early child levels as well. So where we can, we collect the information by gender. We have a rather extensive teacher education website that we've all kind of contributed to, where we have latest snapshots in supply and demand, areas of shortage, and we have information about not only race, ethnicity, but gender there. And I think the campuses have also been trying to recruit in areas in which there are imbalances, and there are, and that is a continuing challenge for us.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And by the way, I would remind the committee that Jim Sager only got here March 1, and so he was not able to do everything in a relatively short time period. So.
Chair Backlund,
yes.
I want to take the liberty to ask you to reopen your work session so I can make a comment about your amendments. I think we have a problem we can fix before you adjourn today, if I might.
Okay. We'll adjourn this one first, then we'll reopen the other one.
Before we get there, Mr. Chair.
Pardon me, yeah. Pardon me?
Right before you adjourn.
Oh, yes.
Just a comment. I can't help but observe that while this report is focused on our success in making our teaching and school administration pool look like our student pool, so that our students see faces that look like themselves. It is also quite poignant to me just to notice totals. The report shows that...
On what page?
Well, on page 5, for example, it shows that in 3 years, our student population has increased by 10,000 or 9,000 students statewide. While in the same 3 years, if you look at page 14, from 1999 to 2001, we have lost 1,000 teaching positions in Oregon. We are asking 1,000 fewer teachers to teach 9,000 more students.
Which, Representative, is another way to say that our class size loads have obviously increased proportionately.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Thank you for bringing that to our attention. That's the sort of information that statistics can provide. And having been an old baseball coach, I like statistics. So, well, with that, we will close the informational meeting. And we will reopen a work session on House Bill 2575. Vicki.
Thank you. Representative Backlund and members of the committee, I want to urge you stridently to reconsider and pass the -4 amendments and not the -1 amendments. We very much need that underlying bill to handle situations like your first witness testified to with regard to the timeline. The -1s truly make cause an enormous problem in the licensure system. It doesn't allow us to require a master's degree for the administrators. It really causes a problem with our design in the higher ed programs. And the -4 amendment would apply only to the permanent license, which is where it is required now anyway. The reason I ask you that is we need the timelines of the underlying bill, and it would require a tremendous amount of fixing in the Senate to get it to where it's not going to cause a huge financial impact in this state. So I'm urging you, before you leave the committee today, to reconsider, and the -4 amendments would accomplish your intent, it's my belief. So I just have to say that I think that.
Okay.
Please.
Well, thank you very much. Discussion. Well, I think my view is I think we should listen probably to people who are involved in the key issues who are involved every day. And so I'm inclined to agree that if this -1 would cause the kind of problems that Vicki commented about, we should probably move to the -4. Okay. Jim whispered a note to me. I think probably he would like some time to check something out, and so we will close the work session on 2575, and we'll move on to we'll come back to this. We'll move on to a work session for House Bill 2600. And Jim, do you want to explain why this has appeared again?
Yes, sir. When we passed the bill, we had asked for the subsequent referral to be rescinded. It turns out that the amendment to the bill reduced the maximum limit of dollars to keep it under the cap that's been imposed, but it's coming out of the lottery fund, which requires it to go to Ways and Means, no matter what the dollar amount.
Okay. Well, we'll be two for two. So, Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and reconsideration of House Bill 2600 be taken up immediately. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Chair requests unanimous consent that the motion of House Bill 2600 to do pass as amended be printed engrossed and rescind the subsequent referral to the Ways and Means Committee be reconsidered. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Hobson.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2600 to do pass as amended be printed engrossed and then to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference, and let's get it right this time.
Thank you, Representative Hobson, and we'll try to. Representative Hobson moves House Bill 2600 to do pass as amended, be printed and grossed, and into the committee in Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion? Gina, would you call the roll, please?
Representative
Hobson? Aye.
Representative
Nolan? Aye.
Representative
Nolan?
Aye.
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 Aye. Having received the constitutional majority, House Bill 2600 is passed.
Right on cue.
Okay, we have one bill to consider. We have some things to discuss, and so we're going to take a quick stand at ease, and we'll be back momentarily. We have found that we cannot reconsider today. It would have to be another time after an announcement of a work session. So that's one thing we needed to find out, and one reason for the at ease. We'll go on to open a work session on House Bill 2744. Jim?
Thank you, sir. House Bill 2744, direct school districts and public charter schools to implement content standards and statewide assessments in mathematics, science, and English. Direct school districts to implement certificate or initial mastery in mathematics, science, and English. Makes implementation for other subjects optional. And we have the dash 11 and dash 16 amendments to discuss.
Okay. And as you know, committee, we've had added for our consideration the dash 15s and the dash 16s. But we think we're going with the dash 11 and the dash 16. Cindy Hunt is here, who has written these for us, and I'm concerned that every time I call her that she doesn't want to hear my voice, but she assures me it's okay. So anyway, Cindy, what can you tell us?
Great. Cindy Hunt, Legislative Counsel's Office. Okay, so the new amendments in front of you are the dash 16s. And what these do is implement the concepts that Ozzie Rose talked about in the last committee meeting from his school administrator group. And so what they do is they work in the concept where to receive the SIM, a student would receive that in math, science, and English. And then after that, the student would receive an endorsement, a subject area endorsement in the other subjects. The State Board of Ed is still directed to adopt requirements for the SIM in those other subjects. Actually, it would be for a SIM endorsement in the other subjects. And then it leaves it up to the local school district whether or not they're going to offer to the students the option of the SIM subject area endorsement. And so that's all found on page 11 of the amendments. These amendments also have the concept of health, or the subject area of health, treated the same as these other subjects.
And that's the difference between dash 15 and dash 16.
Correct. Correct.
Okay.
So.
Okay, any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Nolan.
I do have a question. Thank you.
Okay.
Do I have to?
Or maybe to the author, at least, to the initiator of the amendment. My question is, is a SIM a prerequisite to the earning of a SIM endorsement? Must I have a SIM before I can get an endorsement?
Representative Nolan, the amendments don't specify either way. I think my answer would be it would be up to the local school district, because it's up to them whether or not they offer the endorsement. So, but the amendment does not say either way this time.
Oh, gosh.
We have that. Representative Farr?
Well, we talked about that in our meeting yesterday, and as I recall, the conclusion was that you would not have to have would not necessarily have to have the SIM to have SIM endorsements. That's what I recall the conversation would be.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Yes,
not having participated in that conversation and not having all the benefit of the perspectives there, My understanding of part of the purpose here is to create a uniform definition and awareness in the outside world of SIM. And I would be concerned that a student could say, I have a SIM endorsement in second language, and imply that I have earned the SIM when I haven't. And the potential that that devalues the work of everyone who actually does earn the SIM makes me pause.
Hi, Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My recollection was very similar to that. In recalling Dr. Rose's testimony, I even kind of remember his physical language. You have a SIM, a core SIM, and the endorsements. I don't think he used the wheel analogy, but I think I would, and that a core SIM was indeed necessary in order to then move to the next step, which would be an individualized SIM endorsement in a particular area that we outlined here.
Mm-hmm. I might clarify, too, the meeting that's been alluded to is our weekly meeting with the two vice chairs and the chair, as well as committee administrator Jim Keller. And so that's an ongoing thing. Representing far our recollection of the meeting yesterday was 180 degrees opposite of yours, and that doesn't mean we're right, but that's what we think we recall. And the intent was that we would have a SIM, which again was a core certificate indicating success in the three SIM subjects of English, math, and science, and then the SIM enhancement would be among the other subjects. That would be my interpretation. Now, I don't know if we think we need to make that very specific and include that. That's another issue, I guess.
Yeah. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Bakken.
If that's the intent, I think it would be nice to have that statutorily recognized. And I would also wonder what that would mean for somebody who is a virtuoso on the cello, who could probably have a very good career there and move right to a SIM endorsement in the arts, but I guess as a prerequisite would have to do the math, science, or English first. And why? What our policy reason is for subjecting certain courses, which could lead to as good a career as any, to a second tier. Why, policy-wise, would we do that?
Well, Representative, an excellent question. I guess my answer is we think a SIM should demonstrate proficiency in a core number of subjects. In part now, because of the No Child Left Behind Act, which does mandate the three that we have chosen, English, math, and science. So I guess you could call them the fundamentals or the core or the basics, and then anything among the other four would be an enhancement or in addition to the core.
I would, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would. Thank you for that, and I do understand that. And I guess my response to the federal government would be that if they want to tell the state of Oregon that American history is not as important a core subject as math, then they can keep the No Child Left Behind Act and keep it out of Oregon, mm-hmm. because I certainly don't feel that way. And I would hate to see American history be relegated to second-class status behind math or science.
Well, as a former advanced placement U.S. history teacher myself, I would certainly like to agree with that comment.
Feel free.
Yeah. And we have agonized in meeting after meeting. I must say that, guys, we are narrowing this down to three subjects, and social science is not one of those three, and that's tough. We were trying to be practical, and we're trying to be realistic, I guess. Not that that's necessarily what we wanted to do in terms of the realism that we would have liked would have been to include social science or certainly American history.
I would, yeah.
replaced.
I would add, and I do appreciate really the long hours I know that the three of you have put in, but I guess my response would be that when we're talking about the requirements for assessment under the No Child Left Behind Act, that the SIM is not included within that. We can have requirements for assessment, still be in compliance with No Child Left Behind, and do anything we want to with SIM.
Mm-hmm.
And that what we're choosing to do is in an area SIM not required by No Child Left Behind, separate out the subjects.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there's a good reason for that, maybe there isn't, but I just wonder what kind of a policy statement that gives to our approach of wanting to provide a holistic educational experience for children in Oregon schools.
Well, Representative, again, I think those are excellent comments. I guess I'm thinking back to the original goal that we went into this discussion, which has led to House Bill 2744. Those goals included maintaining high standards, but narrowing the scope in part because of where we are, and also, by the way, to remove some time commitments on teachers and schools. And so it seemed that kind of a moderate approach. Right now, we, if fully implemented, we would have 7 subjects involved in the SIM. There are other alternatives which would totally eliminate the 7 subjects, the assessments, the standards, the SIM, and the CAM. And so, in part, this is kind of an alternative view, and we think it would improve within the concept of our goals, or my goals. So, yes, Representative Hobson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to go back and pick up on what Representative Nolan said, because I think one of our issues here, one of our goals here, is to educate the public and even us to a certain extent that a SIM is a SIM is a SIM, and it means that you have reached high standards, high academic standards in English, math, and science. And I think then if you excel in some other area and want to receive a SIM endorsement, it is adjunct to that or in addition to that. And I would use the example, you might have someone who is an outstanding football player, and certain, not that this ever happens, and might really excel in that and win a scholarship to whatever school and go on to professional, but he or she may not have the academic content standards that were necessary for the SIM. To me, it's apples and oranges and a totally different thing. And I think it's, again, going along with what you said about a compromise here and going along with Representative Nolan said as far as making sure we know what a SIM is as we move forward to that, I think it's critical that we kind of go with what we have here. But I would ask Cindy, and I know I saw her opening her mouth a little while ago, in regard to whether we should have some language that makes it very clear, if that's what we want, that the core is the SIM, or are the SIM. I was an English teacher. That's great.
There's
so much for me.
Representative Hobson, I'm sure I have some copywriters laughing right now watching you. But anyway, who otherwise appreciate having an English teacher in our legislature. But I would suggest, depending on the policy choice that the committee makes, I think this conversation raises the issue that at least there's a question. Either way that you go, whether it's that you can only get these endorsements if you have a SIM, or if the choice is that you can get the endorsements even if you don't have a SIM, that should be specified. Because obviously different people can read this differently, and we never like to see that in statute. Mm-hmm. But it's a policy choice for the committee to make one way or the other. Mm-hmm. I was also told that by a little bird back here who called Ozzy that their original intent was that, in fact, you could get an endorsement and not have gotten the original SIM. So.
We'll put that on hold for just a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Ockian, you had brought up an excellent point. I think on page 11 of the Dash 16, Cindy.
Thank you, Mr.
Would
Chair.
Would you discuss those? Yeah.
Cindy, would you mind turning to page 11 of Dash 16?
I'm done.
Okay. And Section 5 sub C includes health as an option to be offered for the an area endorsement. But in the first sentence of Section 5, health is not listed as a subject that would be that the districts need to adopt requirements in. And I wonder if you could comment on that.
Representative Vakian, health should be in line 9, and that was a mistake. So, thank you. And so if the committee were to adopt these amendments, we would be certain to include that today through a conceptual amendment or something.
Okay. Thank you're you. Saying we could do 2 conceptual amendments?
Yes, you could.
Okay. Representative Dalton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering why we label foreign languages as second languages.
Representative Dalto, where that comes from is back in 1995 when they did the original definition of second language. For this entire 21st Century Schools Act, second language means foreign language, but it also means American Sign Language. And so a student could excel in American Sign Language and meet the requirements of the second language's requirement. Or a school district could offer American Sign Language instead of, like, a foreign language.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, excuse me. Yeah. So, committee, it's not recommended on a normal process that we do conceptual amendments, but we have 2 very I think relatively straightforward, simple ideas to add, and I would be willing to do these conceptual amendments. The one would be to put the health into line 9 on page 11, mm-hmm. And also we need to clarify what it is that a SIM is. Do we have to have a SIM before we have any SIM? Do we call that SIM endorsements? Or SIM enhancements?
SIM endorsement.
SIM endorsement.
And that,
an area endorsement.
Mr. Chair, is a bit of the hitch.
Okay. Then the name or the whole concept?
Endorsement. If it's an endorsement to the SIM, if it's a SIM endorsement, as the language says here, if I get a motorcycle endorsement on my driver's license, I have to have a driver's license first.
Yes.
It is an endorsement to that driver's license.
Yeah.
And I think I'm not the only one who interprets it that way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It may be that by changing it to kind of an endorsement on a high school diploma, for example, so that it is not part of the SIM, but it says this course of study has value as well that is significant and important and worth recognizing academic accomplishment on. I don't know if that's the right one, but not connecting it in language to the SIM.
Cindy, we're making it more difficult to do something conceptually here.
Yes.
It may not be as easy as doing.
Just say diploma endorsement instead of SIM endorsement.
I see anything.
Any comments? Anybody?
Question? Oh,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
Well,
Representative Hobson.
Yes. Representative Hobson.
I would just go, if we're going to have an endorsement to the diploma, I'm not even sure what that means. That's like saying, having an A grade the same thing? It distinguishes theoretically something great there. I guess I really go back to the fact that the SIM is the core showing outstanding accomplishments, and I go along with the motor vehicle analogy there. And if you have something that enhances that by having a U.S. history or in some other area, that it is in addition to the SIM. And I think that's good for any number of reasons, but I'm very concerned about the public understanding this. We're looking at trying to get it on applications. We're looking at trying to work it in with the OUS system, those kinds of things. And I think it gets really way out there if we have enhancement, endorsement to the diploma part to it.
Yes.
Chair Backman,
The other thing about the diploma endorsement, not that you could not do it, but it would also add the concept of, right now we don't really have the requirements for the diploma in statute. We sort of direct the State Board of Ed to do them, and we direct the school districts. And so, and under this direction, the State Board of Education has adopted various unit credit requirements to receive a diploma. And so, for example, social sciences, 3 credits. So I think in order to do a diploma endorsement, you'd have to sort of say, what are your original diploma requirements in statute? It would seem kind of logical. So that would be sort of a major addition to the amendments, but not undoable. Or, I mean, it would just take some time to do that.
A different policy direction than what we've been discussing. Yeah. Representative Hobson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And going on with Rip City Devakin, I had straight A's in orchestra all through high school, but I can guarantee you that I should not have an enhancement or endorsement to my diploma because of my fine arts skill on the violin.
Okay. For those of us who have been around a while, are you comparing yourself to Jack Benny?
But I mean, no.
Hmm? Oh. Yeah. I had a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Bakken.
If we step out of Dash 16 for a second, we look at what the requirements were for a SIM under the old system before we got into all these amendments. And then compare that with what the requirements are for a SIM subject area endorsement in these topics. Is there any difference?
Good question. Representative Vakian, I think the biggest difference is the addition of health, because all of the other subject areas are currently part of the SIM, and we haven't told the State Board of Education to change their standards.
Let me clarify, because the requirement maybe was the wrong term to use. For the attainment of any individual subject area SIM endorsement, Would the requirements for getting any single one of those be different than any single one of them under the old system when they were just SIM, or is it the same?
Representative Vakian, I think it's the same. Of course, the other big difference is that now, I mean, under the Dash 16 amendments, is that the option of the school district, whether or not the school district offers a SIM or a SIM endorsement in those additional subjects, whereas under current law,
right,
the school district must offer. So that's another difference.
But if they do offer it, the student has to perform the same exact things to get the endorsement that they would have had to perform to get a SIM.
Correct.
On the old system.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Which would beg the question to me, what's our policy reason for the new name? Maybe there's a good reason for it. I'm just struggling a little bit with.
Mm-hmm. Well, my initial answer, Representative, is that we're trying to get some common understanding of what is the meaning of a SIM, so that, as Representative Hobson said, a SIM is a SIM is a SIM is a SIM. So we're trying to get this core standard understanding of what a SIM represents to anybody and everybody. And then if a student were so inclined to go beyond the basic, that would be permissible under Dash 16. That it would have to meet the same standards as the current law would indicate. Representative Hobson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm understanding the discussion correctly, Representative Vakian, that would allow a district who has fully implemented the SIM to the extent that we already had it, the option of doing that. They just wouldn't call it a full-blown SIM as we had back in the old days last year. It would be a SIM with the 3 cores, and then it would be the endorsements in one or all of the following, and then you would have, in a bigger picture, a full-blown SIM, if you will.
Maybe we should add an amendment for a full-blown SIM. That might be very impressive on a resume. I'm sorry, Mr.
No. Well, it appears that our subject matter here that's under discussion is a bit more complex than simply a conceptual one. The conceptual one earlier on being the health edition, that would be relatively simple.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Farr?
Thank you. Each place that the endorsements are mentioned, it looks like it's called the
Certificate of Initial Mastery Subject Area Endorsements.
What page are you on, Representative?
On this, I'm on page 10 on that one, and also on page 10, the first line.
Okay, on dash 16?
Yes, that's
okay.
Dash 16.
Okay.
So it seems to me that if we just dropped the words Certificate of Initial Mastery and allowed them to be called Subject Area Endorsements.
Representative Farr, it would depend on what you wanted them connected to. You know, whether, for example, they would be connected to a diploma versus connected to the SIM, and then also the committee's prior discussion about whether you could get, you would have to, if you're a student, you'd have to have achieved the SIM in order to get the endorsement.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's another question. But if the committee, of course, was so inclined that they didn't like the concept of the endorsement and just wanted the SIM, you have other amendments that do that. I believe like the dash 13s and 14s do that in various ways.
Well, follow up. The endorsements are an important part of it to me. Because it's... I believe it takes in the root of clarifying to people beyond high school precisely what it is that... Mm-hmm. That the SIM and the endorsements demonstrate that the child is proficient in. So, I guess to me it seems clear that if we drop certificate of initial mastery and just call them subject area endorsements, then it could be up to the school district to decide what they attach them to, whether it be to a SIM or just be standalone endorsements.
Representative Farr, I think I would want to add in a sentence that it very clearly leaves it up to the school district what they attach them to. Of course, right now, too, there is additional language in here that specifically directs the state board to adopt the requirements for these endorsements. So that would be,
mm-hmm.
And right now that language is found in the SIM statute. So they're very specifically connected.
Then would it allow then the school district to attach it to the SIM if the student has achieved the SIM, and just let it stand alone if the student hasn't achieved the SIM?
Representative Farr, I mean, I think the way that I would read the current language is, it's at the choice of the school district right now,
because mm-hmm.
they're the ones that have decided whether or not to offer this endorsement. So. But I can see where people are reading it in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I think my earlier statement was this is an area that should be clarified. And
thank you.
And I do have some language that would clarify it here that I've kind of drafted. But, so a sentence, something to the effect of a student may only receive a SIM subject area endorsement if the student has received a SIM. If that's the inclination versus...
Mm-hmm. I would be fine with that.
Representative Scott.
That's pretty much where I was headed. If we're going to go through all this, and we're going to get to dash 16, that we put a lot of consideration and thought into it, then I think that we should probably have where we do have the requirement to obtain, and then we can eligible to get the endorsements should one want to proceed with that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
So I kind of like what has been said.
Yeah. That Cindy has just read.
Precisely.
Yeah. Cindy, do you view your sentence that you just read for us as a conceptual amendment, or do you think it requires coming back with that plus the health in here?
Representative Backlund, no. I think we could amend this in, and then with the health amendment, if the committee was so inclined to pass the bill out today. But if the committee was going to hear the bill again on Friday, in the meantime, I would draft an amendment there. Because
okay.
the preferred way is to have the actual language
right,
in front of
right.
you to avoid
yeah.
issues. But
yeah. We can't complete our work today, whether we stand on our heads or stay here until 10 o'clock at night, because we need a fiscal. And so we need to consider the fiscal side of it, too. So I would think that we could come back on Friday, which we are already scheduled to do a work session on Friday, anticipating the fiscal. So we could come back with these amendments and send you to draft those.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Excuse me. Could we proceed with the fiscal based on the information we have in hand without the dash 17s? We could.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a request also for Chuck Bennett and Jim Green to testify, and I think that would be appropriate. So, Cindy, if you have one more thing or any more, please keep going.
Chair Backlund, the other thing I was going to suggest is that if the committee was inclined to adopt the dash 11s, dealing with the work sample issue, those also could be incorporated into the next set of amendments.
So if it would be, in effect, be a gut and stuff, and,
exactly.
And it would just be one package.
Mm-hmm.
We need... Okay. Does your testimony conflict with that?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I would encourage the committee to take a couple of days to allow these to be looked at. There's one issue that I saw that deals with charter schools, unfortunately, because you require that the charter schools also meet these new requirements, and you make that effective under the dash 16 amendments for the 03-04 school year. We have contracts currently in effect between school districts and charter schools that may not contain all the information that's in this bill. So you would be, in effect, changing their contract. Mm. And I believe you may want to address that issue somehow with regard to the contracts they've got in force. The best way would probably be to say it affects any charter school brought forward after this date or the renegotiation of existing contracts, because you may impair their ability of their current contracts, which I don't think you want to do. And Cindy may be able to correct me on that. But
a little bit.
We have some contracts with charter schools because they've received waivers from the state board that could be in conflict with this law that would be in place.
Mm-hmm. Chair Backlund, there may be a policy choice around the contracts, but I'm guessing what Mr. Green here is bringing up is that any time you generally do a law that affects a contract between a state actor and a private party, you can't change the terms of that contract. That's well-established constitutional law under the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. And although in the case of the public charter schools, it's between two public entities, so those same constitutional provisions don't arise. So technically we could, but from a policy perspective, we may not want to.
And in particular, Mr. Chair, I'm thinking of one school, one charter school that's going to begin next year, which is the Center for Advanced Learning, which is the three school districts up in the East Metro area that are not having a complete content standard curriculum. They have waivers to provide only parts of it. And under this law, they would be required at least to perhaps comply with all of it. And it's just an issue that I throw out there because we do have those negotiated agreements. And the issue on whether it's a public versus a public, we don't know yet because, remember, public charter schools are private nonprofit corporations. So it's an issue that I think may need to be addressed, at least in this amendment, somehow.
Jim.
Isn't this fun?
If you were to bring your concerns to the current law, would that make any difference? The current law relating to the seven subjects if fully implemented? And
well, they are, Mr. Chairman, they are required currently, charter schools are required to comply with the content standards and the state assessments, just like a school district is. However, there have been waivers granted by the state board, at least in the one instance I'm thinking of, for the Center for Advanced Learning, because they're not offering a complete curriculum. They're offering bits and pieces of a curriculum, and that's to address the CAM, actually, for those students up there in the school district, and I just don't want to try to put something onto a negotiated agreement between those three districts that shouldn't be there for that charter school program.
Now, you understand that if we were to pass 2744 in something close to its present form, we have delayed the CAM until 2008. Does that make any difference?
Mr. Chairman, that doesn't make any difference because it's the fact that they did get a waiver from the provision that requires a curriculum be across all because they're not providing that. And I spoke with Randy Carnage, and we're not quite sure exactly how this would impact them. The best and cleanest way to probably go about it would be to say it applies to charter schools that are created in the future or upon the expiration of contracts currently in force.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Green, isn't it possible, and maybe I'll ask Randy Harnish to nod, that's all I ever ask him to do in the back row there, those waivers are still appropriate and could still be received dependent upon the Board of Education? I noticed nods from the back.
Representative Hobson, that's correct, because where the waivers come in is in Chapter 338. There's a provision that if the state board finds certain things, I can't remember what those are, they may waive the provisions of Chapter 338 with the exception of certain the unwaivables. And one of the unwaivables actually is the list of mandatory subjects that actually is listed in page 20 of the Dash 16 amendments. And so, like, for example, currently a charter school must participate in a statewide assessment system and then also offer academic content areas, which currently would include everything but health that's talked about in the bill. So it's my recollection that the state board currently couldn't waive an academic content area. Now, the CAM and the SIM has not been applied to the charter schools, so it would be up to their charter whether or not they offer those. So, but without knowing about the specific waivers that have been granted, it's kind of difficult to speculate how this would apply.
And arguably, Mr. Chair, if you had this private non-corp and the public entity and you add health to the list of things that they have to do, it may impair their contract.
Yeah. Health may not have to do, but could do. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
No, it's a may.
Yeah, Jim, the health right now is, of course, it's a requirement for high school graduation. But it would be in the list of optional subjects.
For purposes of the SIM.
For the purposes of the SIM, yeah.
Yeah, so a charter school under this, there's nothing in here that says to the charter school you have to offer a SIM.
Right.
And that's current law, and that remains the same in this bill. Same with the CAM. I mean, so that doesn't change. But what I'm uncertain of, there may be certain charters where the charter school, I'm looking to Jim here, has agreed to offer the SIM. That's possible.
I'm sure there are.
Well, it's always exciting to get some new information. We say information is power, and so it looks like, Cindy, we have more than conceptual amendments to bring to this, and I think I would ask you to maybe combine the Dash 11 and the Dash 16, I think, into one bill, I think, and then add the amendments that we've been discussing to those. And so we're on for Friday. Hopefully we'll have a fiscal on Friday, and we could wrap this up.
Chair Backlund, just so that I'm clear, would you like me to work here with Mr. Green to incorporate his concepts directly into the committee amendment, or would you like those as a separate amendment that the committee could consider separately?
Separately probably would be better. And I'm sure, Cindy, that you would be able to work with Mr. Green. He's very agreeable to work with, I know.
Well, we'll see.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah. Cindy, we're not going to make those 20 amendments that you talked about earlier.
Not a goal. Yeah. Not a goal.
No, okay. Okay. Any further comments, committee members? As usual, we have a great time, and we hear a lot of information, and we want to get it right. We're committed to doing that, and we could get a bit impatient, but we're not going to because we want to do it right. So I think with that, we can bring the work session on House Bill 2744 to a close. And Jim, you had a comment about 2575?
Oh, yeah. Very good.
Okay. And we'll adjourn the meeting.